about 8 inches within which I can see. So, good evening, Bodhisattvas. Hope everybody's had a lovely day.
Is there enough light, Penny?
Yeah, it's really good. Thank you, Mark. Yeah. So what I want to talk about tonight, I think, has some pertinence to taking refuge, though I won't talk about that explicitly, or maybe just a little bit at the very end. But, you know, we talk about, in our tradition, not taking refuge from, but taking refuge in, right, in the midst of all of it. And so that's the spirit of this talk, I think. It's got a couple possible epigraphs. So one would be a poem by William Carlos Williams, which I hope to have time to return to later. It's just called Poem, and it goes, "As the cat climbed over the top of the jam closet, first the right forefoot, carefully, then the hind, stepped down into the pit of the empty flower pot." So you could wonder why that's a poem or something like that. It's also maybe like, why is that Zen? So we'll try to get around to that. And then another possible epigraph would be, I think it was a World War II song. I'm not sure about the GIs coming home, but it was something like, "How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry?" You know, so this talk is sort of about that. And then if you wanted a Cliff Notes summary of the talk, I could do it in one word, and it's a word that John Sutherland wrote as a kind of cartoon thing on the back of my Rakusu when I took refuge, and it just says, "Blam!" So that's the Cliff Notes for the talk. So last night I invited you to spend some time with some kind of make-believe wannabe koans. "There's someone at peace walking in the Tao," or "There's something already at rest, where is it?" or "Where is awakening, I wonder?" And I hope you got fetched by that a little bit from time to time today, and it kind of wafted you or floated you into a space that felt peaceful and kind of free and easy. And I hope also that maybe you encountered the sense that you didn't have to manufacture it for yourself, you didn't have to work hard to get there. It's kind of a gift, and it's available to everybody, and actually we're already in it. Once we've tasted it, I think we do have that sense that we've always known it, we're always there in some way, but we also have the experience that it can wax and wane, and that in general, once we're back in the, you know, so-called hustle and bustle of the so-called marketplace in the tradition, we're a little bit less likely to feel it so often or to feel so deeply in touch with it. And that can be hard sometimes. So one of the things I want to stress, and again, I think it does have a lot to do with taking refuge, the Zen tradition has got tremendous enthusiasm for that kind of return, right? So Yuan Wu, who's the editor of the Blue Cliff Record, keeps saying again and again in his commentaries on the koans, especially after there's been some sort of dramatic sense of emptiness, he says, "Okay, but when you get here, you need a place to turn around. You can't stay here." And great Master Ma used to say, "For the Bodhisattva to be stuck in emptiness is to suffer the torments of hell." So we know that, but I think still we might want to stamp our tiny feet a little bit and say, "I don't want to go back there." You know, so that's the "how you're going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Peri part." So in Zen speak, I think that has something to do with the sense of the absolute, you know. So we say, "Oh, I've known the absolute, and I know I have to put up with going back to the relative, but that's not the real deal. It's just the sort of humdrum outside of real experience, and it's not the real Zen thing," you know. Or we could say, "Well, it's the dues I have to pay to be a dutiful bodhisattva." Right? So I want to talk a little bit about this sense of the absolute and relative, and maybe begin to spin it a little bit in a couple different ways. So the absolute is often associated with sameness or oneness, and when it's talked about that way, it tends to be opposed to mere multiplicity or mere difference or the merely relative, which is sometimes said to be merely apparent, but really when you get down to the real, it's all oneness, you know. And I think that's not completely wrong, and our experience of the absolute as a kind of oneness can be deeply moving and transformative. You know, that sense of, "I'm not separate, I'm part of the whole interweaving shebang." But it's really easy to turn into not just a kind of Kensho junkie, but a oneness junkie. It's kind of like, "Oh, rats, I'm seeing difference or separation again. Damn, I've lost my third eye." You know, so that's a kind of... So one of the briefs of the talk tonight is something like the following. What if difference, even startling particularity, is right inside, there's someone at peace walking in the Tao. It's right inside those moments. What if it's already a key aspect of what the Absolute is? And what if we experience it as part of our sojourn in the place where there's someone, where there's something already deeply at rest? Where is it? So what if that sense of difference is right inside those moments and not what we got to put up with when we're exiled from the real deal? Right. So there are a lot of ways of talking about how the tradition really stresses this. And I'll mention one and then do a little kind of theory stuff and then really get back to talking about this difference thing as part of the Absolute. But just even the traditional translation of the Shito Shichien taking part in the gathering, like in Zen Center and other places, it's translated as the harmony of sameness and difference. So that's already saying, you know, sameness and difference, different and not different, both those things, you know. All right. So here would be the theory part, I guess. So doesn't the tradition evoke oneness as the thing we're missing and the thing that we've got to find? And I would say, yeah, in a way it does. All right. So one thing to say is that the tradition certainly works to dismantle our deconstruct how we humans conceptualize and therefore experience separation or difference. It's a human tendency built into language. I know I keep saying this, but so does everybody else. It's a human tendency built into language to sort and separate, to divide things into categories and name them. And then, and it's really hard not to do this, to think that the differences we've generated through our complex human thinking are baked right into reality. That just as the way we're a kind of difference-making machine in our conceptual thinking, oh, we must be getting to really sort of discrete atomic separate particulars, right? So we tend to think that things are really and ultimately separate. The dog isn't the cat, the good isn't the bad, and maybe crucially and right at the root, I as the knower and namer, I'm separate from the world out there that I'm naming and manipulating, right? And then this is sort of in bad taste, but I thought of it today. So I said, things are separate, this I know, for my language tells me so. So you could go to the Lankavatara Sutra or to the Yogacara tradition, the mind-only tradition, to find both of them talking dismissively of this, you know, regarding of differences and separation as absolute ultimate reality, as merely imagined or merely imagined reality, right? That's not how things really are. It's a, you know, a sort of delusion created by our language. And in a really dismissive term that's kind of nice, it's called projection only. So if you see that, you're just projecting the categories of your mind out there into the world, right? Then the next thing both the Lanka and the Yogacara tradition with Vasubandhu, let's say, would say is when we break through that, we get a sense of what's weirdly enough called dependent reality, which I always find misleading because it seems to mean interdependent reality. So instead of seeing things as separate, we're noticing the way in which they're all products of causes and conditions and they're all interrelated. So that's regarded as, oh, that's better, you know, but it's still a kind of conceptualization. And so there's this moment, which we tried to talk about yesterday, when knowing stops. And that's the moment in some way when thoughts are still rising, but they're close to sensations. The conceptual structure might not be completely gone, but it's really falling into the background, sort of rising and falling faintly, or it's like a little chatter in your head, but it's not really where the action is. And in those moments when knowing feels extra, right, and there's someone at peace walking in the Tao, what we experience, and you know, again, to talk about it is already to conceptualize it, but it's something like just this sort of endless interweaving, rising and falling, not modeled, not conceptualized, right? As the Heart Sutra says, no wisdom and no attainment, since there is nothing to attain. That's like the Yangtze Shuan Shui, not fleeing delusion, not seeking truth. Okay. So this aspect of things where they're ineffable or innameable or not nameable is the realm of the Dharmakaya. So it's the realm of an experience or a world beyond categories. And it's the realm where, as the Lanka would say, we're not throwing out our projections. So the conceptual thinking and truth, desperate truth seeking has kind of fallen by the wayside. So that's also conceived of as how things really are. And that's sometimes translated as suchness or thusness. It's related to Tathagata, the name of the Buddha, which could mean both thus come or thus gone, but also true suchness or maybe the really real. And it's beyond category. So it's beyond that kind of difference-making machine. And it allows us to see that things are not ultimately and only separate and discrete, though this I know because my language tells me so, and it allows us to feel that the interconnection or interweaving or interpenetration of things is not merely trivial or secondary, right? But so again, it's really easy once we've experienced something like this and heard oneness talked about as the absolute to see difference and separation as a fall, you know? So it's like, I used to see difference and separation, but hallelujah, I've been reborn, and now I see only oneness. All right. So if we associate that oneness from which difference would be a fall, which separation or individuality would be a fall, we can still be really startled by something that Joan Sutherland said at a retreat here in Tucson in 2012 about Tathagata or thusness. And I've quoted this before, and so every time I have to apologize for continually using Connie as the example, but Joan looked across the room and focused on Connie, so Connie forever is now our example of this. So here's what Joan said, right? We come to love things for their thingness, which is called Tathagata, their thusness, their suchness. The complete Connie-ness of Connie is her Tathagata. We come to love not Connie in the abstract, so I think that's the thing about how it's not conceptualization, right? We come to love not Connie in the abstract, but Connie in all her specificity, in all her particularity. And again, this is talking about thusness, suchness, what we see in the absolute, which very often, like in Ben Connolly's book, at least in one part, is just talked about as oneness. And Joan is saying really the opposite here. The Tathagata of Connie comes to life, and that becomes something we love. It becomes the sense of the real, the taste of it, the look of it, the smell, the touch, all of that particularity becomes real. So I think in those moments when there's someone at peace walking in the Tao and we kind of slid into that, we may not feel that right away or immediately. We may get that sense of interweaving and so on. But at some point, that's going to come forward, and it's really unmistakable and important. It's also canonical, right? I mean, just go right to the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. All right. So another term that might function the same way is non-duality or non-dual thinking, okay? So one of the things to note is that that is in some way another favorite term of something like Buddhism 101, and it might also benefit from a similar jostling or shaking up, right? So here's Norman Fisher in a talk actually about the Ben Connolly book that he gave recently, Doing the Shaking. And on the way to it, he notes, I love this, he notes that our very notion of non-dualism, since it's contrasted to dualistic thinking, is itself dualistic. So as soon as you do, I'm all for non-dualism. Well, you're screwed. You know, so all right. And then he says, when we're in the zone of no projections, we experience the profound realization that everything is one, and the only way this oneness ever appears is just like this in front of us. Perfected reality is not just oneness, Norman says. It's both oneness and not oneness. And of course, it has to be that way. Actually, there is no escape from dualism or non-dualism. As soon as you decide it's one, it's not the other, you're doomed and tangled. Life is always both. And the Zen masters are constantly harping on this point. This really sounds like Norman. He says, as soon as you think it's one, kaboom, it's the other. That's what they're always doing, those guys, those Zen masters. The point is also made really clearly in our open source Pacific Zen School translation of the poem I mentioned before, the Shitto's Harmony of Sameness and Difference, which we call Taking Part in the Gathering. And again, we quote this really endlessly. We and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven. And this interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. So it's part of it, okay? Not only that, but this each thing standing in its own place isn't just something that we have to put up with. It's completely glorious, and it's one of the most startlingly beautiful gifts that Zen practice has to offer us. I'm always embarrassed about this, but there's a koan, and there are two colors, and it would be important to remember the colors,
yellow,
but I never
blue.
Do. Yellow, that's what I got right after. That's right, thank you. Okay, so the koan is, the yellow is not the blue. And I remember Joan saying about that, once you experience it, it's unforgettable. And that's that, like the Tathagata of Connie, you know, the yellow is not the blue. Once you experience that, it's unforgettable. All right. So the tradition insistently actually celebrates both aspects of thusness, both the interwoven and not interwoven, both the interwoven and the standing in its own place. There's a, this is actually in the checking questions to one of the koans, so I can't tell you what koan it's to, or it would spoil the fun, you know. But I will. It's Yasutani Roshi, you know, who's in. He's the teacher of Yamada, who's the teacher of Aiken. Anyway, it's our tradition, and he's talking about a Dharmakaya koan. I'll say that. So he's talking about thusness or the absolute, and what he says is, sparrow goes cheep cheep, crow goes caw caw, right? So in a way, those are just two sounds that the two creatures make, and in a way, both the sparrow and the crow are full of both interweaving and not interweaving, both interweaving and standing in their own place. But I think they're kind of archetypes here in some way. So the sparrow sound is really soft, you know, so it's a cheep cheep, sounds like, you know, let's interweave, that would be great. And crows or ravens don't sound like that. The caw caw is not saying, you know, I invite you to interpermeate with me. It's really, I'm the crow, back off, you know. And when Yasutani quotes that, he's not at all saying to be like the sparrow is bad, or when you see the sparrow aspect, you're getting oneness. When you see the crow aspect, you've just fallen into the merely relative. They're both part of the Tathagata of Kani, like they say. All right. So I was going to quote a lot of Suzuki Roshi on this. I'll just quote one little passage. I'll say one other thing about it, but it's an absolutely terrific and important book. It's his book on, and it's Suzuki Roshi, not D.T. Suzuki. It's his book on the Shito, taking part in the gathering, which he calls the Sandokai by Sekito, since they Japanese everything. But so here's what I'll quote, and then I'll just say one other thing. It says, in Zen sometimes we say that each one of us is steep like a cliff, and I'll come back to that later. No one can scale us. We are completely independent. But when you hear me say so, you should understand the other side too, that we are endlessly interrelated. If you only understand one side of the truth, you can't hear what I'm saying. Shito's words are double-edged. One side is interdependence, and one side is absolute independence. This interdependency goes on and on everywhere, and yet things stay in their own places. This is the main point of the Sandokai. That's what the Shito is about, he's saying. The other thing which I won't bother to go into is he uses the Japanese terms for the absolute and the relative, which are ri and ji, and he goes on at great length in a passage that's kind of breathtaking, indicating that this sort of standing in their own place that I talked about, the separateness, is ri, not ji. And so he said, the moment of ji is the moment when we start conceptualizing it and building all these categories around it, but the experience of the Tathagata of the particular thing, he's quite clear, and it's really breathtaking to read if you haven't thought of this before. He says, that's the absolute right there, you know, right in your face. So that's pretty important, I think. All right. If there were another section to this talk, which in a way there is, it would be called two shoes dropping, you know, like first shoe, second shoe, right? So in our tradition, we stress that we wake up in relationship. Something, some particular thing, tumbles us into the terrain of thusness, sometimes suddenly or dramatically. I think the interwoven independent paradigm I've been evoking is crucial to such experiences, a feature not a bug. And it's often a two-step process. I don't know if it's always true, but in my experience, it tends to be this way. So to talk about this, here's an enigmatic condensed sentence in Joan's recent book about getting fetched. She's talking about the Zen tradition's insight that awakening happens in relationship. In the old stories, you suddenly see peach blossoms on a mountain path. It's the same in our lives now, though it might be a neon sign on a foggy night rather than peach blossoms. And then here's the tricky sentence. We, in the Tuesday evening study group, we spent about an hour on this. A particular other becomes unmistakably real, reminding you of who you really are. Well, first off, reminding is a kind of droll understatement. It's too mild a term for the jolt of this experience. But second, what does reminding you of who you really are evoke? Like, who are you, or what are you, really? Partly in these moments, you rediscover that you are completely interwoven. Peach blossom, me, no difference. That's me. Fetched suddenly and dramatically into the interweaving which is going on all the time. But what about this? And here's the Williams poem again. As the cat climbed over the top of the jam closet, first the right forefoot, carefully, then the hind, stepped down, into the pit of the empty flower pot. When I hear this, I feel the catness of the cat, that particular cat in those particular groping and hesitant motions, as if in my own body, which lets me identify with it, feel the cat moving through me. That's true. But I also feel the foreignness of its catness, its not tenniness. And then in my experience, in the next moment, or maybe somewhat later, I feel the womp of life coming up into my own particular body, my own particular embodied tenniness, not a cat. Like Frank O'Hara says in a poem, "Yippee, I'm glad I'm alive." So that's the blam. Right? So here's Williams on these the two parts of this process, and we should let him say something because it's his cat poem after all. So he says poets, but I think he's talking about people. So poets are taught by the largeness of their imaginations to feel every form which they see moving within themselves. That's that sense of identification, right? But also, he says elsewhere, nature possesses the quality of independent existence, of independent reality, which we feel in ourselves. And so that's part of the fetch, you know, that the sheer catness of that cat, of that tree or whatever, not only reminds me I'm one with, but that's me too. I have that, you know, blam quality as well. So this two-sided quality, separate and not separate, can occasion a lot of joyous levity and some kind of weirdly, quintessentially offbeat Zen humor. So this is a little koan about Yangshan and Sancheng, but I'm going to do it with me and Megan instead, because it turns on knowing what their Dharma names are, and we don't know the Dharma names, so we get all mixed up. So it's like this, like Megan's the teacher, and I'm a pilgrim, a student, and I come to see Megan, and I have my first interview with Megan. And so here, this is the koan just with the names changed. Megan asked Tenny, "What's your name?" Tenny replied, "Megan." Megan said, "Megan, that's my name." Tenny said, "My name is Tenny." And then I love this word. Megan roared with laughter. You really don't want to miss out on this aspect of the Dharma. It's glorious, and it can also carry you back to the farm with the conviction in your bones that you really haven't been exiled from Paris. Right. Then if there were another section, which there is, it would be called Precipice. Right? So this non-interwoven aspect, each thing standing in its own place, is glorious, right? Each thing independent, but it's also no laughing matter. Here's a great little koan, it's actually on the koan handout, by Miao Zhang. And just parenthetically, Miao Zhang, she was a student of the great teacher Dawei. And one of the things we're told is that Dawei's the one who boiled the Blue Cliff record down from those really elaborate cases just to the Watteau, to the single sort of koan point. And supposedly that process came about through Miao Zhang's particular koan work. There was something about the way she did the koan work that sort of enabled Dawei with her collaboration to sort of invent this new method of working on a koan. So that's not particularly pertinent here, but it's a cool thing about her. So here's the koan anyway. Each being's eternal radiance appears before you. Each being is an 8,000-foot precipice. Each being's eternal radiance appears before you. Each being is an 8,000-foot precipice. I don't think this is a good cop, bad cop moment, okay? I don't think it's like eternal radiance good, 8,000-foot precipice bad, but maybe it's not that so bad because, hey, maybe it's only a delusion produced by your unenlightened, unregenerate way of thinking. So don't worry about the precipice. It's not real. I don't think it's that at all. You know, it's both each being's eternal radiance appears before you, and just as importantly, and just as much part of the Dharma, and just as much part of the Absolute, each being is an 8,000-foot precipice, right? So if it's a precipice, it's not warm and it's not cuddly. It's imposing, it's impenetrable, it's recalcitrant, and it's full of danger if we approach it ineptly. It doesn't feel like a sparrow moment, but kind of like a crow on steroids, right? But at the same time, that 8,000-foot precipice rising up sheerly in front of us is also radiant, right? So both the eternal radiance and the precipice are qualities Zen helps us learn to love and admire and to feel in ourselves. And it also gives us a kind of buoyancy to roll up our sleeves when we have to and deal with the real difficulties of having precipices in front of us. So in a talk that a lot of you know and love, Joan Sutherland calls this kind of double aspect of things the shimmer. Everything is of this world, manifest, phenomenal, measurable, and at the same time everything is empty, vast, eternal, not changing, not rising and falling, like the things of the phenomenal world. Everything is both of these simultaneously. That is the shimmering quality of everything, the non-dual quality. So non-dual is not different from dual, right? The non-dual dual quality. Simultaneously eternal and impermanent. In the beautiful technical language of Chan, everything is both mysterious, made of the vastness, and wondrous, manifest, phenomenal of the world. There's a beautiful shimmer in the fact that these two things are occupying exactly the same place at exactly the same time in each of us. The problem isn't that how we're seeing things is wrong, but that it's incomplete. We're not seeing the shimmer of things. We're not seeing the simultaneity of emptiness and manifestation. The solution from the tradition's viewpoint is awakening to that shimmer, being awake to steadily see both aspects of reality simultaneously. It's never about choosing one or the other. It's never about, there's this messed up deluded reality that we're all aware of, and there's this other truer shiny thing over there, and we're going to choose that. It's never about that. It's about seeing both of them simultaneously, seeing how it shimmers, bringing them together into a whole that excludes neither of them. If our challenge is that we tend to exclude the shining eternal aspect of things in the present moment, the solution is not to then go there and exclude the manifest, phenomenal nature of things. It's to bring them together, including, I would say, the 8,000-foot precipice. So these words came really luckily to hand. I love this. And they're actually the right words. Even if we might rather live in the midst of a charm of sparrows rather than a murder of crows. In for a penny, in for a pound, or as William Carlos Williams says repeatedly in his book-length epic poem, Patterson, so be it. All right, so there's another section of this about the precepts, but I think I've gone on for plenty long enough, and I think what I'd like to do is just see if there's any conversation, and, you know, depending on how the time goes, I might say a little bit about the precepts or not, and then we'll have some time for sitting and other things. But I think that's probably plenty to hang on to for now. So. I know my talks tend to be fairly condensed and chock full of things, which is why I wanted to offer the one word blam as the clip notes. But if anybody does have comments or questions, I definitely welcome those. Thank you.
In light of these wanderings, what would you say about not fleeing delusion? What does that mean to you?
Yeah. What I think that's about is more about what I talked about last night, more than tonight even. That is, the project that we're interested in is in some way never a project that ultimately ends with finding a model that would be the truth, right? So, I mean, delusions are things going on in our minds. They're models that it ain't so or it ain't necessarily so. And so if you think that you're trying to flee delusion and seek truth, you're trying to get out of a bad model into a better model. And that's not stupid, and I can say some more about this in relation to precepts maybe and to the other weird stuff that the Lanka says about imagined reality. But if you think that you have the kind of wrong, it's like a Platonism. If you think you have the wrong models, but there's this other model that's a perfect match for reality, and that would be the true model, the Zen tradition, like American pragmatism, says that ain't so. All the models are models. Right, and all the models, the Lanka is kind of extreme about this, but the Lanka says all the models are projection. And partly what that means, which I think is really important, is in any model, I'm over here as the knower and the modeler, and so it's falsifying something really essentially the case about reality. Like, I'm not the knower of it, I'm in it. And in the moment when the knowing project falls away, I can really feel that in my bones. And there's a kind of simplicity to that. You know, it's like, oh, no shit. You know, so that's it. Right? And then, of course, modeling will return because it's instrumental and all that. But the notion of, I got to get rid of the delusive models to get to the true model, it's not how it is. So let me actually say one of the things I was going to say in relation to the precepts, because I think partly with the precepts, when we take them up as koans, we learn to hold our formulations lightly. So that's part of the thing about how they're not rules. Anything we formulate is likely to be wrong in some way. So they're our best guess, and they're always subject to change. So the part I talked about in the Lanka or the Yogacara tradition says perfected reality is the absence of modeling, right? In that sort of cognitive sense. And that's the thought after thought, you know, just, gosh, look at the artwork. These are just more thoughts rising and falling, just like the world is rising and falling along with it. So it isn't a kind of cognitive task. And in those moments, it's like, at least for me, I haven't really stopped thinking, so I'm kind of still doing a little modeling. But I know that that's not where the action is. You know, it's just like, oh, I'm just in it. And there's something already sort of calm and perfect about that. There's something already at peace. There's something already at rest. And when modeling falls away, I feel myself part of it. So perfected reality, the suchness thing, is we're just seeing, you know, the interweaving or the blam of Kani without a lot of conceptual structure on top of it. But conceptualization's always going to return. Modeling's always going to return. And if we're in a world with precipices, it's a damn good thing that it does, right? Because thinking better be instrumental, and, you know, what are you going to do about that precipice aside from anything else? So the Lanka says the wise who, when they're in that zone, don't throw out any projections. There's a couple ways of saying it. I'm relying on Red Pine here. One version he says is the wise are neither deluded nor not deluded by their projections. So you have a sense, in a way, like the model, in a way, partly you want to say, oh, the model's just a model, just like any other thing rising and falling, but it's still, you know, partial though it is, it's an instrument that I'm going to use, but I know it's not the absolute match for the real, so I'm deluded by it because I got to think in terms of it, you know, but I'm not deluded by it. And then he also says in a kind of self-contradictory thing that I love, he says, the wise don't project their projections. So it's like, you know, and that's got real import for the precepts, I think, you know, sort of any way we would deal with, and I can say some more later if we have time, but any way we would deal with those 10 bodhisattva vows, I vow not to kill, I vow not to steal, in a particular situation, we're always going to be sort of cobbling together what our feel for it is, partly out of our sense of emptiness and partly out of our sense of suchness, but, you know, we're going to have to make ourselves some kind of roadmaps to go by. But we're really aware that they're just roadmaps and we don't take them too seriously. And we're also aware that to the extent we're making roadmaps, even if the roadmap says I'm in it, the very fact of making the roadmap, you know, I'm over against it. So we also know in a way that the very act of modeling is removing us from a certain kind of intimacy with the situation, even though paradoxically it might, if it's a good enough model, it might facilitate some intimacy. So another way I like to talk about it is to say that if we've experienced this kind of projectional state, in some way we see through our projections. This is another way of saying what Red Pine said. We see through our projections in a kind of doubled sense. So on the one hand, we see through them like we'd see through a fraud. You know, I see through you, you scandal. I mean, you scoundrel, I won't be fooled by you anymore, right? But at the same time, we sort of see through them like a pair of glasses, which help us see things, but not perfectly. So we're seeing through our projections or our models in a doubled sense. That's a very long-winded answer, but does that speak to some of what you were asking or something else you want to follow up with?
I was thinking about it in terms of whether I'm making duality or not, or thinking that whether I make duality or not is how I flee delusion.
Yeah. Say, I don't understand the last thing you said. I think I just said this.
Well, in terms of what you said in the talk, you know, we think if we're not making dualism, then we're in the truth zone.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So Right, that I think that's another version of what I was trying to say, right? So if we say, oh, dualism is delusion, so I'm seeing non-dualism, so that's truth, right?
Right. Yeah.
That's just another dualism. And which is also, again, to sort of go back to the Lanka, anytime you're making a model, it's a model. Anytime you're in knowing, you're out, you, well, that's not right. Anytime you're in knowing, in some, I'm going to be very careful here, in some way, there's some other kind of experience that you might have had where you've just fallen into it and there isn't any urgency to know anything. The modeling kind of falls away. The other thing that's implicit in what I was saying about the wise nearly projecting, not projecting their projections, is the tradition also tends to say, oh, okay, so that modeling is just something else that's going on, right? So from another point of view, the deluded models or the helpful models you're conjuring up are, you know, also just something else rising and falling, right? So it isn't, it's real important and it's kind of subtle, but so the claim would be that, and it's important for retreat too, like if your mind is busy thinking, you know, you can think, oh shit, you know, I've fallen out of this suchness thing, right? But from another point of view, like your thinking going on isn't any different, you know, from the cat climbing over the jam closet, right? And that's sort of, you know, Joan saying to somebody in that Q&A on the sound file, oh, when you walk into a room, if you're completely discombobulated and angry, the person said, oh, but so if I realize that that's just something rising and falling, then that's it too. And Joan says, yeah, that's it too. So that's important. There's a, from the perspective of this, there's a kind of lightness with our own fucked upness, you know, about what's going on in our head. It's like, oh, it's removing me from it. But if there's even just that little bit of sort of turning the mind around partially, it's like, oh, but this is it too, you know. It's just, and I know people have talked to me about this already during your retreat. It's just something else that's going on. Okay. So that goes back to where I started last night, which is like that the sort of eradicating conceptual thinking forever is not the project, you know. And that's for me, that's part of the thing about Zenism and the fundamentalism. If you think I have to get rid of scientific method and modeling and making my spreadsheets, you know, that's not going to go well. Yeah, Lonnie, hi.
Yeah, I was just going to sort of summing it up for myself by saying, gosh, the minute you realize that you've had a moment of not knowing, you're back in knowing.
Yeah.
So it's like,
yeah, and
the crux is just don't worry about it. Just
Well, the Suzuki thing is everything goes as it goes, right?
Yeah.
I think that's right. That John talks about that too. Like it's always going to happen, right? Like, oh, yeah, I'm in the midst of a beautiful experience, and then oh, I'm having a beautiful experience, and then yeah. But then it's like, oh, there was this thought that I had the beautiful experience, and there was this other thought that I fucked up the beautiful experience by having the thought that I had the beautiful experience. And I mean, in a way, like we can't, like, you know, the Suzuki thing, we don't love weeds the way we love flowers, he says, you know. So in a way, it's hard not to really love the moment when you're not doing that. And it's hard not to be kind of frustrated with the moment when you're doing that. But it's just what we do, you know. And again, there's a kind of free and easy quality to that. And again, with the Suzuki thing about everything goes as it goes, or everything changes, and I know John talks about this a lot too, you know, if we don't sort of tighten up around that, right, it's likelier to sort of dissipate sooner. Yeah. It's not irrevocable, you know. Yeah, Jen.
You're talking about an experience that I was having right before the talk tonight, where, and maybe the end of last block, whatever, where I had such a, like you said, I hope you had a peaceful, beautiful day. Well, I did. And then I was starting to think, well, this never lasts. You know? And it's like, I mean, then I had to sort of talk myself down off the ledge of, okay, don't get worried about it. Like, if it's going to be a bad day, okay, maybe. And I mean, I've had experiences where I had, you know, supposedly really bad days, but it was just like I was working on no, and it's like, okay, this thing happened, and then my flight was canceled, yeah, and my luggage was lost, and then this, you know, it was like, is this a problem? No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Problem?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. That's good.
You know, so So it just sounds like what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know what?
Yeah. That reminds me of two things. So one is like a Norman Fisher story, and I love Norman's sense of humor. So he says in a toxic place, he says, like, people are always complaining. You know, he says, well, I go to retreat and I have these beautiful experiences, you know, and I really, and he says, but they never last, you know. And Norman just says, well, that's impermanence, right? what did you expect? Right? And then the other side of that is Suzuki Roshi saying in that beautiful book, Zen is Right Here, you know, the little anecdotes, right? Somebody says the same thing, oh, they never last, you know, what's the point, you know? And he says, you're right, no point. Nevertheless, if you keep practicing, there's something underneath all that that remains.
Right.
There, yeah. Right. So it's like even in the, so that's another answer, a response to Lonnie, that in a way, even in the midst of, you know, everything's all screwed up again and I'm turbulent again, if we have a number of experiences where that's kind of fallen away, you can really sense that there's something underneath it. That's also what I like about there's someone at peace walking in the Tao. You don't have to worry about whether it's you. And I also have the sense that John's also got the thing, don't check your mind, you know, so we're always sort of checking, is it there? And after a while, I think we get the sense that it's not going to go too far away. And this is also related to there's someone at peace walking in the Tao. If I'm not feeling it, I don't have to worry, something else is holding it. Like if I'm not holding it, the trees are holding it, or somebody else in the room is holding it. You know, that deep peace is somewhere. And you start getting the feeling that if you just reached out your hand a little, you could at least sort of close enough for government work, sort of find it in the neighborhood. You know, it's like, oh, didn't. The other thing that's like that is, oh, you know, I've lost my Zen practice. I'm very far away from koan work. And then you just think of a koan for a second. It's like, oops, it came back. But that takes some you know, some steadiness, I think, some long-term immersion in the practice, probably. Yeah, John.
I didn't think I was going to have anything to say, but is there another way of looking at this to say it might be useful to think that I want to try to become comfortable with change? Like, we know change is going to happen. Change is inevitable. And if I'm comfortable with it, not that I always am, but if I can try to attain to be comfortable with it, but that's kind of the same thing. We're talking about that's that underlying structure that you were talking about that Zen offers. Because, I mean, I just had that kind of experience. Megan and I were talking about it earlier, actually, where over the course of a year, something very dramatic here at the Redemption Center, for me, changed. And it somehow is representative of things changing, some of which I didn't like, some of which I think, oh my God, things all went wrong, and I don't trust the process.
Yeah.
But if I'm comfortable with the fact that things are changing and trust that that is the process, maybe I'm just not holding it now.
Yeah.
Is that kind of...
I think so, and I think that's... Megan evoked that last night with the way of talking about, you know, moment by moment, it never stops flowing, right? That, of course, it's going to change, and rather than trying to, you know, grab hold. But then, of course, grabbing hold of it is what we do, right? I mean,
it
takes some practice not to do that, and it's never perfect, I think. You know? In her talks on self and soul, one of the things Joan says is, like, the self is really really freaked out by change. You know, it's trying to make everything permanent and stable and eternal, and so it can never perform its task. It's always going to lose. So that thing about, oh, of course everything changes, you know. Somebody asked Suzuki, it's also in that book, you know, I've been listening to you for years. Could you just sum it all up in one sentence? And the person says, of course I knew that was a ridiculous question. He wouldn't answer it. And Suzuki just says, everything changes. Yeah. Yeah, John.
You know, I just want to quote, because I don't know, I think this is part of this, but, you know, so there's someone at peace walking in the Tao, not beyond theories.
Yeah.
Not seeking delusion,
not fleeing delusion,
not seeking truth.
Yeah.
And then the next two lines always thrill me also. Even ignorance is Buddha nature itself.
Mm-hmm.
The illusory body is the body of the way.
Yeah. That's what I was trying to talk with Martha about, right?
Yeah.
Right? That's, you know, oh, so I'm running around with all these deluded thoughts. The moment when that turns around just a little bit, oh, that's it too, right? It's just something else rising and falling. Right?
Yeah, it just feels like something for me to
try
and grasp onto.
Yeah, yeah. And since thinking is, like when I talk about instrumental, I'm talking about American pragmatism, where they think that, like, human thinking must be part of the human, you know, natural selection because it's adaptive. So our thoughts are instruments by means of which we can take hold of and manipulate reality. So we're not going to walk around all the time thinking, oh gosh, look at the weird thought. You know, we're inside that structure and we're trying to use it for something. So we're always not, maybe there are moments we're not, but most of the time we're always going to be caught. And the best we can do, I think, is, you know, caught and not caught, right? Not projecting our projections. And I can certainly feel the periods when I'm really projecting my projections, and my family could tell you about that. You know? And then every once in a while, I'm sort of not projecting them so much. Yeah. So Lonnie and then Fred.
Something happened that I found really exciting one time. I think it's kind of what we're talking about, which is that for me, though, when you had one of those moments of not knowing, or one of those moments of sort of seeing through the, I think of it as the sort of scenery, the scrim, then more of them seem to happen, and you seem to kind of, it's almost like I was picturing, you know, it's like there's a part of it, and then there's another hole, and then there's another hole, and another hole. And it just seems to be that even when you can't hold on to that first hole, you start to recognize that they start to happen more. And so, I don't know, it's just sort of a...
I think that's really important, and I think it has something to do with Cohen practice, and it goes back to what John was saying, I think. There's so much emphasis in our school on the kind of softening and opening that's part of our work with Cohen's, and everything that's part of your, that's your response to the Cohen is part of the field of the Cohen. So there's a way in which, you know, even if we tend to sort of clench up and it's like, got to answer the Cohen, our real experience of spending time with it is really the opposite, you know, of a kind of gradual sort of loosening up of the way we want to think about it, and seeing what comes. And that's, again, the sort of everything goes as it goes. So I think at least our way of working on koans tends to facilitate what you're talking about, you know, that you have more and more of those kinds of experiences. And for me also, this sort of terror of going to retreat, which I remember very vividly. There was somebody I knew who used to faint before every retreat, you know, which is like, the self's going to die. but that sort of experience of walking into the unknown and sort of, be, like Martha said, anything could happen, that's just invaluable, you know? I mean, it feels, you know, not perfectly at all, but it does, for me, seem to have some carryover to other kind of big and scary moments that I might encounter. You know, it's like, oh, it's just like going on a retreat.
Yeah, Fred.
So I've been thinking about how all this relates to the precepts that I'm going to be taking in a few days, and not projecting my projections made me think about the precept about not speaking maliciously of others, gossiping maliciously of others. And I'm actually thinking of a particular incident that happened last summer where I gossip maliciously to my wife about somebody else who'd done me wrong. And, you know, I have this big mental model about the situation and about this person and have lots to share about it. And, you know, I was projecting my projection. And so, I mean, that was, on one hand, that was creating harm. Because it wasn't directly to the person, that mitigated a little bit, but I mean, it created harm in the universe. Also, what did I miss? You know, I mean, I totally missed the suchness of this person.
Yeah.
I can find this person to my mental image, which was totally incomplete and extremely uncomplimentary. Who knows what she was really all about?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's, I mean, it wasn't about not having a model, because there was probably some value in that model.
Right.
I don't maybe understand it, but it's kind of about learning to go beyond it.
Yeah.
So
I think, so exactly, a couple things about that. So the model locks us into a view of things,
yes.
And so if the model falls away, like if you're in a situation that feels recalcitrant, you know, the model that you have is unlikely to generate change in that situation. But sometimes if the model falls away, you notice something about the other person that you wouldn't have seen if you were locked in the model. And at that moment, it starts to feel like, oh, something else might be possible. So that's one thing. The second thing is, I think what you're talking about precepts work involving sort of seeing what our projections are. And that's the Diane Rossetto thing on the precepts. I think she's really good on that, about sort of finding the sort of still point, and then she also talks about finding out what your requirements are, like what are the sort of implicit models and rules that you've, what are the requirements you have with a situation, of a situation, in order for it to be tolerable. And a lot of times you're not even aware of what those requirements are. So that's again part of the kind of precepts as Cohen thing, I think. Yeah, John.
I'm wondering if you could say something about, you know, we don't know something, you know, we can't see it with our mind, even with our models and whatever. But sometimes our body give it away, yeah. and so there's some knowing somewhere,
yeah.
You know, and it's not completely coming through, and I just wondered if you could say.
So there's like two sentences in Jones' book. It's something like, it has come to my attention that show me are the two most terrifying words spoken by a teacher in work in the room, but that's the very heart of the matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, again, also our way of working with concepts. That's partly why I quoted the Williams Cat thing. I mean, there's stuff that goes on bodily as you respond to that poem.
Yeah.
And there's stuff that goes on bodily in our engagement with Cohen's that is transformative, you know?
But it's easier to see in the cat than it is in your own body.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's
maybe that's the fetchability thing, though. And it's like the Yunmen thing, you know, everyone has a light inside, but when you try to find it, you can't. It's dark, dark, hidden. What is your light? And that's partly about fetchability. Like, you can't, and that's also, you know, there's someone at peace walking in the Tao. Well, damn, that's not me, you know? Well, don't worry about it. Just notice it outside, and then, there it is.
Yeah.
And then there's like the second shoe. Oh, it's me too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Joy.
This might be the cat falling into the flower pot, other side of John's comments. When people project onto us something about us. My practice has taught me over the years to really take a step back from that. Mm-hmm. You know, the old me, or maybe the young me, however you want to, you know, phrase that. or younger, would have gotten very defensive,
yeah.
Right? But sometimes now, not all the times, but sometimes now I can step back from that and at least ask myself the question, hey, they may have a point, and you need to think about this.
Yeah, that's good. I don't have anything to say about that, except you're probably better at that than I am. That's great.
I wouldn't say I'm better at it.
No, I think
so
that's
it's, yeah, yeah, so it's more, yeah. I guess, a comment.
Yeah,
but
that seems really important. Yeah.
You're younger than that now.
Well, you know, this comet's coming back in like 70 some odd years, right? And we're going to be here for that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, sure.
I'm thinking of this beneath, this under, what part does intuition play in all of this?
Can you say a little more on that?
Bodily, is it the same as the bodily senses, or?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like in part it is, and then intuition comes to me also in images sometimes, right?
Yeah. Intuition or even premonitions.
Yeah. I'll just tell the story that I always tell about this. I don't know, Megan, you might want to say something about the intuition thing also. Remember the Chicago experiment somebody told me about? There's some, they had these, I think middle school kids or upper elementary school kids at the psych department at the University of Chicago, and they put these two beakers in front of them, and remember, and the beakers had almost the same amount of water. It's really hard to tell the difference, but one was a little bit different, and they would ask the kids which beaker has more water in it, And almost all the kids said, oh, they're the same, right? But in the moment before they said they're the same, they'd moved a hand closer to the beaker that actually had more, you know? So, yeah. And I think Cohen work works that way a lot, which is what's so lovely about it.
Is that sort of sixth sense type of thing?
Yeah. Well, maybe it's like, you know, when we can, when the models get thinner, the sort of the quieter voices can perk up. And so we're giving space, and sometimes they feel like they come from a deep place inside, and sometimes they come from somewhere else, you know, like that we're receiving. But it requires that kind of stillness, so we're actually channeling that and not some funky model.
To tap into that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And for me anyway, like practice has made me trust that a little more. I'm not so startled by it, or that it's smarter than anything that I had.
I mean, I've had experience with and I knew it this, and maybe that, you know, helps me somewhat. But I'll sit with a koan and just something will come out of left field, you know, that's very pertinent in what's going on in my life.
And that's such a lovely marker of a true kind of intuition, is that it's a surprise. It's not like, oh yeah, that's what I thought should happen, you know.
Yeah. Because, you know, my parent, the way I was raised, there was nothing but models.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We don't do this, we don't do that, you can't say that.
Yeah. Yeah. So in a weird way, like the Cohen work is a discipline, it's sort of the discipline of no discipline, in the sense that it also seems to have some carryover, right? Like sort of outside Cohen work, I feel like I can allow that to happen a little more in various circumstances. Yeah. Anything else? Do you want to say anything else? That's good, right? It's 8:48, so. Thank you.
Excuse me, one more thing yet. How are you going to keep them down in the furnace that came back in World War I?
Oh, thank you. Okay. Thank you.